Okay, in this lecture, we're going to do a once-over-the-world look at the different kinds of people and jobs that are running the modern healthcare system. So, there we go. If I get my screen to flip. Okay, so broadly, we're going to talk about these categories of health services professions. So we'll talk about physicians, we'll talk about these non-physician mid-level providers, nurses, of course, because that's huge, and some others. So first, let's start with physicians. Broadly speaking, we have a relatively narrow group of people who are called physicians. They have, some of them have different degrees. So the most common person who is referred to as a physician in the United States is an MD or medical doctor. You are also going to be exposed, likely, and you might have, without even knowing it, have been cared for by a doctor of osteopathy. That's a DO. So if you go to see a physician and you look at their credentials, most likely you're either going to see MD or DO. The difference between MD and DO is primarily historical. It was a different approach to medicine. DOs had a more holistic perspective, and modern physical therapy really grows out of the osteopathic tradition. They did quite a bit of manipulation of the spine as part of their normal practice. Today, so my younger sister is a DO. She learned a little bit of manipulation, but as a family medicine doctor, she does not really use it. Some DOs still embrace it, but for the most part, there's very little difference in the training that DOs and MDs get, maybe a little bit of a cultural attitudinal perspective, a little more holistic on the DO side. But that doesn't mean that MDs don't have holistic perspectives as well. It's just a little more of a cultural leaning in the way that they train. Also known as physicians are podiatrists. So this is a doctor of podiatric medicine, or a DPM. They go through their first 2 years of podiatric training is basically identical to what an MD or a DO would do. They then focus on care of the patient, basically below the knee. And then naturopathic doctor, or ND, has a long history in the United States coming out of the homeopathic tradition. Your book has a little more on that. I have an interview with one of the first naturopathic doctors in New Hampshire. So when you come to your assignment to listen to one of my interviews, you can, if you're interested, you can look for her. Okay, so physician training. They go through a lot of training. So first, in order to go to medical school in the United States, that's a graduate program. So you have to earn a BA or a BS, so a Bachelor of Arts or a Bachelor of Science. Doesn't really matter what you get it in. You can get a bachelor's degree in English or philosophy, as long as you take the required pre-medical coursework, which includes dream killers like organic chemistry and physics. So physicians will graduate with a bachelor's degree. They then go to medical school. Medical school is 4 years. The first 2 years are basically classroom didactic in most programs, not all, but in most programs, followed by 2 years of primarily clinical rotations where they get to get exposed to all the different fields of medicine that we'll be talking about here in just a second. After they finish medical school, they are legally doctors. They have to complete what's known as an internship, which is typically is 1 year and is typically done as part of the residency process today. Technically, that allows them to go into practice. Almost no one does that anymore, in most part because no hospital would allow you to practice there without being residency qualified. So the vast majority of physicians do their BA 4 years, medical school 4 years, and then they go on to do a residency, which is where they start to specialize in a particular kind of medical practice. Residencies last anywhere from 3 to 7 years, and I have a list of them for you to look at. Some programs, some types of physicians have to do not only a residency, but a fellowship. And we'll talk about that in a minute. Followed by they after they complete their residency and or fellowship, they have to take boards to become board certified. So you'll hear someone referred to as a board certified orthopedic surgeon or a board certified obstetrics and gynecology physician. So let's talk about the different kinds of specialties. And there are some various ways to categorize physicians, and none of them are perfect. But broadly, medical and surgical have the longest history in the way that we think about the way physicians are organized. So physicians, once upon a time, used to strictly be medical, and surgical was done by, as I mentioned in previous lectures, done primarily by barbers and other non-physician types. And so physicians thought of themselves as kind of above doing surgery. Now, this attitude changes greatly when we get into the 1850s and we have anesthesia, and surgery can be more than just a barbaric last resort intervention and can become much more articulate, much more precise, and just creates a whole new avenue of medicine. Psychiatry is sort of a separate and very recent discipline coming out of the early 20th century. And in particular, really the mid-century, when we had drugs that actually began to work to treat mental health conditions. And then the last category I'm going to call hospital-based, which are physicians that primarily do their work in a hospital setting in order to support other physicians, typically. So we'll come back to all of those. All right, so let's talk about the kind of medical specialties. So I'm lumping in here primary care, and the different kinds of primary care doctors include family medicine, pediatrics, and if you skip down here, internal medicine, which is adult medicine. So the difference between family medicine and internal medicine is family medicine takes you cradle to grave. So family medicine doctors, so my sister, I mentioned, is a family medicine doctor, learned how to deliver babies as part of her residency. And then they treat the individual from birth through developing their families to old age and ultimately death. So family medicine tries to treat the patient along the whole lifespan, whereas internal medicine only does adults. So if you're an internal medicine doc, you know something about taking care of children, but you really only treat adult patients. Pediatrics, on the other hand, really only treats pediatric patients. So 0 to technically, some pediatricians will see you into your 20s. The human brain, in particular, the male human brain, continues to develop through the mid-20s. So pediatrics, and you can have a subspecialty of adolescent medicine, deals strictly with developmental, you know, early life developmental issues. Now, neurology and dermatology are residencies that don't require an internal medicine residency first. So you can go directly from medical school to a neurology residency or directly to a dermatology residency. So neurology is a treatment of the nervous system, and dermatology is a treatment of the skin, right? And the skin is actually technically is the largest organ in the human body. It is an organ in that it performs particular functions. Now, I have internal medicine down here at the bottom because even though it's a primary care specialty, internal medicine is sort of the gateway to a whole slew of other medicine subspecialties that require a fellowship. So one thing I want you to remember is neurology and dermatology don't require a fellowship. That's a straight into a residency. Whereas all the rest of these require first, all the rest of these internal medicine subspecialties require first medical school, then an internal medicine residency, and then you can do a fellowship. So if you want to become a cardiologist, for example, you have to do medical school, internal medicine residency, become board certified in internal medicine, and then you can become, go to your cardiology fellowship and become a cardiologist. And then there's even more subspecialization there. Endocrinology is study of the endocrine system. So this is all your things like all your glands. So if you are have trouble with various hormones and secretions, such as relate to growth. So if you have slow growth, if you're having trouble with stress, things like that, you'd likely see an endocrinologist. They deal with, so for example, some of my family members, their thyroid fails to work. So they have hypothyroidism. It means their thyroid doesn't function at a high enough level. But thyroid is a governing part of the endocrine system. And when it fails, it causes a whole slew of other problems. Gastroenterology is a study of the digestive system. So it's if you have issues with your stomach, issues with your bowels, at some point, if you're lucky enough to make it to 50, you'll get a chance to go get your first colonoscopy, which I had the privilege of getting a couple of years ago, and I'm be getting one again in the next couple of years. So good times there. Hematology is the study of blood. Infectious disease is the study of things like COVID-19, right? So that's, and HIV. So diseases that are transmitted in human society. Nephrology is the study of the kidneys. Oncology is the study of cancer. Pulmonary is the study of the lungs, and there's more. So you don't need to know all these, but you should generally be familiar with them. And the main point I want to make here is if you're seeing any of these subspecialists, they do medical school first, internal medicine residency second, and then they do a fellowship. And then there are all of these have subspecialties as well, further subspecialties. Now, going back from the medical side to the surgical side, we have a whole slew of surgical residencies, some of which you go directly to a particular kind of surgery, and again, some of which you'll do a surgery, a particular residency first, and then a fellowship. So general surgery is going to work with the bowels. So the stomach and bowel is included, but generally the abdominal area is what I was trying to say rather than the bowel. So that would include everything down to the bowel, large intestine, small intestine, etc., but also the stomach, the esophagus, liver, gallbladder, and so forth. So it's all the soft tissue, in your abdomen. Orthopedic surgery is bones, right? And then within orthopedic surgery, we have subspecialties such as spine, hand, hip, etc., where someone likely would do an orthopedic surgery residency first, then do, say, a spine fellowship or a hand fellowship where they get additional training specializing in a particular bone system. Urology is the study of the urinary system. So this is going to deal with reproductive organs as well as it has connections, of course, to the kidneys, bladder, and so forth. Plastic surgery is dealing with primarily with the skin. And we tend to think of plastic surgery, we tend to think of cosmetic surgery, but cosmetic surgery is really a subsection of plastics. So plastics, a lot of plastics work with restorative surgery. So if you were in a car accident, so for example, my daughter was at one of those trampoline parks and she did a flip and landed such that her knee connected directly to her nose and it twisted up her nose. She wound up having to have plastic surgery to restore that. Plastic surgeons work a lot with burn patients to restore the skin. So it's really surgery primarily around the skin, but it does, a lot of plastics do restorative stuff for people who have been harmed in some way. OBGYN, of course, is delivering babies and women's health related to the GYN system. Ophthalmology is surgical interventions on the eyes. So this is different from an optometrist. So an ophthalmologist is a physician and a surgeon. So they do surgical procedures such as cataract surgeries, repairing your retina, things like that, as opposed to optometry, which where there is no direct intervention with the eye. And then neurosurgery, as opposed to neurology, neurosurgery is surgical interventions on the nervous system. So a neurosurgeon might work on your work on your brain. So brain surgeon work on your spine and so forth. So let's talk about psychiatry. So psychiatry is, I have a great discussion about what psychiatry is with Dr. Jeff Fetter. And so if you're interested in the field of mental health and in particular psychiatry, Dr. Fetter is the chief medical officer at the New Hampshire State Hospital, which is the New Hampshire's state mental health facility. Psychiatry, as you hear Dr. Fetter talk about, is really the use of pharmaceutical interventions to work on mental health disease. So it follows a medical model, right? It looks at the brain as an organ and how it interacts with the body. They do some talk therapy, but again, it's primarily a biological model. And it's not just the brain. There are other connections between the brain and other organ systems. So really fascinating. But it's important to remember, psychiatry is different than psychology. Psychiatry is a physician that follows a medical model to treat mental health. So their main tools that a psychiatrist uses is pharmaceutical interventions. A psychologist uses talk therapy or testing to diagnose and treat, but does not, for the most part, use pharmaceutical interventions. Only a psychiatrist can do that because they are also a physician. So psychiatrist does 4 years of medical school and then does a psychiatry residency. There are also some psychiatry fellowships. We won't get into those here, but you could further subspecialize into child psych and things like that. All right. So let's talk about this weird category of hospital-based physicians. So emergency medicine is a relatively recent specialty, and an emergency medicine physician specializes in working in an emergency department. And emergency departments are, for the most part, only in hospitals. Now, there are some standalone emergency medicine facilities, but they are all connected to a hospital and within a reasonable drive of a hospital. So their specialty is saving life, limb, eyesight, rapid diagnosis. You should only be going to an emergency room if you are in danger of life, limb, and eyesight. That's what an emergency is, and that's what your insurance company will tell you if you show up and don't need emergency care. Radiology, we'll talk more about medical technology soon, but a radiologist uses various imaging tools such as X-ray, CT, MRI to look inside your body. They also use radiology technologies to do things like treat cancer. So they are the ones who would radiate your cancer. Pathologists specialize in diagnostics, so they use advanced laboratory technology in a hospital and they oversee all the testing. So if you ever had to pee in a cup or have blood drawn, all that stuff was going and you were in a hospital, all of that was going to the lab. The lab is overseen by a pathologist. But also if you, say, had surgery and the surgeon removed something from a potential tumor, and they were trying to figure out what it was and whether it was cancerous or not. That biopsy or that sample would be sent to the pathologist, who would then examine the tissue and make a determination about whether the tissue, the tumor, was cancerous or not. So all of those, really, all these specialties really exist primarily in a hospital or setting. And then anesthesiology, of course, is the use of anesthesia. So it specializes in anesthesia and pain control, really critical for transforming surgery. We didn't have anesthesia until the late 1840s. We only had very primitive things like a bottle of whiskey. And that creates other kinds of risk when you're going under surgical care. So a funny personal connection, if you haven't noticed, my last name is Bonica. And I have had some anesthesiologists in my class, and they see my name and they're like, oh my goodness, who are you related to? Dr. John Bonica. So Dr. John Bonica, so Dr. Bonica paid his way through college and medical school by being a professional wrestler. So here's a picture of him as a young man, as a professional wrestler. At various points, he was known as John the Bull Bonica and things like that. You know how you guys seen the pro wrestling stuff, right? So in his pro wrestling career, he was injured a number of times, and as a result had chronic pain for most of his life. And so after he became a physician, he chose to become an anesthesiologist, and he studied pain management. And so he is known basically as the founder of modern pain management, which is kind of cool. He's a second cousin of mine from the same island off of Sicily that my dad is from. So just a little fun fact there. So thinking about different specialties, just to give you a flavor of how, you know, why physicians choose the paths they choose. So I've got some of the different specialties so you can see how much they earn, as well as how many years it takes post-medical school to complete the training. So, for example, if you want to become a family medicine doctor, it will take you 3 years post-medical school or 7 years in total of medical training, and you'll earn about $250,000. Not too shabby. You could become an internal medicine doctor with the same amount of training. So you'll notice pediatrics, family medicine, internal medicine, all the same amount of training. They make in the same ballpark, you know, and this is, again, median. So this is the middle. About half make more, half make less. Hence, it's a median. A relatively new innovation in healthcare is the hospitalist. So this is an internal medicine doctor who decides, I don't really want to do an outpatient practice. I don't want to have a panel of patients that consider me their doctor. Instead, what I'm going to do is I'm going to work for a hospital. And whenever a patient is admitted to the hospital, I will become their primary doctor, and I will oversee the medical care that they're getting in the hospital. Now, this is typically on the medical side, unless they're admitted for something specific like cardiology. So you can see hospitalists tend to make about $307,000, which is quite a bit more than their outpatient-oriented colleagues. And this is because hospital, when you're dealing in the hospital, you're tending to generate some really big bills. And so hospitalists get to participate in that larger income stream. Now we get into some of the big money. Go down here. So a cardiologist does 4 years of medical school, 3 years of internal medicine residency, and then 3 years of cardiology. So a total of six post-medical school, or a total of 10. They earn a median of $529,000. Not bad. GI docs, similar amount of training. I think that's actually on the low end for GI. And this is a couple years, this data is a couple years old. If you go down to the surgical specialties, you can see orthopedic surgery. Orthopedic surgeons do very well. Median income of $619,000. But if you specialize in spine, $835,000. So one of the things we're going to talk about here in toward the end is the maldistribution of physicians, first and foremost, between the different specialties. So why do you think somebody decides, I think I'm going to not be a family medicine doctor, and instead I think I'm going to become an orthopedic surgeon, or better yet, a spine surgeon? Well, yes, they have to do 2 or 3 more years of training, but they make 3 times as much income for the rest of their life after that. So, and then if you go down to dermatology, for example, dermatology, you only have to do your residency 4 years after your medical school. So a total of 8 years of training versus 7 years of training. And you make, you know, if you're comparing yourself to say a family medicine doc, you're going to make $220,000 a year more for the rest of your professional career. So why do you think people wind up choosing to be specialists rather than primary care? Well, a big factor is money, right? Quite bluntly, a big factor is money. Specialists make a lot more money than our primary care providers, but our society needs more primary care doctors than they do specialists. So and the thing is that the government sets most of the reimbursement policies, basically sets what the income will be based on the specialty. And then we turn around as a society and complain that people don't want to be primary care doctors. They only want to be specialists. So we'll talk more about that down the road, but I just want you to kind of be aware that economics, right, is a real factor here. All right, so let's leave physicians and talk about what we now call mid-level providers. Early in my career, we're called physician extenders, but that's not said in polite society anymore. So we had the 2 big ones are physician assistants and nurse practitioners. Physician assistants and nurse practitioners are similar. The main difference is a physician assistant used to be a 2-year degree, went up to a 4-year degree, and is now a 6-year degree. They were trained to work with a physician, hence physician assistant. So they work under the license of a physician. So most of them started out as primary care assistants. The idea was that they would be a cheaper way of providing basic primary care, and anything more complicated that they couldn't handle, they would refer to a physician, family medicine doctor, or a internal medicine doctor. Nurse practitioners come from they have a very much a medical model. Nurse practitioners grow out of the nursing field. So in order to become a nurse practitioner, you have to do a 4-year RN first, and then you do a master's level, 2 more years training to become a nurse practitioner. Nurse practitioners and PAs are very similar in terms of what they can and can't do. They're not doctors, but they can do much of what doctors can do. Now, more recently, PAs and nurse practitioners have moved into a whole range of other subspecialties. So for example, I had a small growth on my back, a small tumor on my back. It was a sub right below the skin, just looked like a little bump, about the size of, by the time I had it excised, about the size of a quarter. That was actually taken out in the clinic. So local anesthesia. So just gave me a couple of shots in my back, and then they cut my back open, scooped out the tumor. And that was done by a nurse practitioner. So nurse practitioners are now doing general surgery, are becoming general surgery specialists. So they support general surgeons, but they also do, one of the more common ones is a psychiatric nurse practitioner. So this is often a psychiatric nurse who then goes on to get her nurse practitioner, his or her nurse practitioner degree, so that they can administer psychiatric medication. Some other flavors include, in particular of the, from the nurse side, include nurse midwives. So a nurse midwife is a woman or man that is trained as a nurse first, and then does follow-on training, so an additional 2 years, learning how to care for pregnant women and then manage the birth. Very popular with some people because it has less of a clinical feel and more of a holistic feel to it. Certified registered nurse anesthetist, or CRNA, it is likely if you get surgery that, unless it's a very complicated case, it's likely that you will get a CRNA to deliver your anesthesia. My wife has had a CRNA do her epidural when she was delivering our second child. I've had a CRNA do my anesthesia when I had my colonoscopy. So they're great. They are, again, it's a 4-year RN followed by 2 years or 3 years now, depending on the program, of anesthesia training. And there are others, but that's a good introduction. This photo is of a friend of mine, Karen Clements. She used to be the chief nurse at Dartmouth Hitchcock Hospital and now is the chief nurse at Mercy Hospital in Portland. And she's sort of on a retirement pathway because she moved to Portland because that's where her grandbabies are and that's where she wanted to be. But she's a fabulous person. And she is, you know, she was an RN with an MBA. We have multiple kinds of nurses. Historically, they were, we'll talk more about the history of nursing in a later chapter, but you can today, in today's medical system, you will run into 2 or 3 year RNs, which are meaning they have had 2 years or 3 years of training and then taken a nursing exam to get their RN license. You will also see bachelor's level or BSN, so Bachelor of Science in Nursing. That's the level that we train to here at UNH. But being a registered nurse doesn't rely on the number of years specifically. So you can become an RN with only 2 or 3 years of training or up to 4 years of training. All nurse mid-levels, so what we were just talking about a minute ago, so the midwife, the CRNA, the nurse practitioner, have to earn their BSN and RN first, then they can go to advanced graduate training. Should be graduate, not graduated training. Advanced graduate training. You'll also see in a hospital, nursing home, or clinical setting, you'll also see non-RN nursing staff, such as a licensed practical or vocational nurse, LPN or LVN. These are people who've had typically somewhere around 2 years of training, and they have a higher level of clinical practice, but not to the same level as an RN. So they can typically administer medication, for example. CNA or LNA, so certified nursing aide or licensed nursing aide, in New Hampshire is one of a handful of states in the country that require licensure to be a LNA versus simply getting a certification to be a CNA. So that's the difference. It's a full license versus a certification. With a license, you have to apply to the state to get your license, whereas a CNA, you take a test and you're done. With a LNA, LNAs are in the state of New Hampshire, LNAs are managed by the state board of nursing. So if someone if you were an LNA, someone could file a complaint about you with the board of nursing, they would do an investigation and then they could take away your license. That's the main difference. No license to take away with a CNA. The CNA just simply means you completed the training. It doesn't mean that you're a professional. So let's talk about pharmacists. All of us have used drugs at some point, hopefully legal. Most likely you went to a pharmacy. Pharmacists function in hospitals, in clinical settings, outside of the hospital, as well as, of course, in retail. So, you know, we probably most often think of your retail pharmacist at, say, a CVS or maybe at your grocery store. But all hospitals have pharmacies because they have both inpatient and outpatient pharmacies. We'll get into that a little more later. But so higher levels of care. Pharmacists are specialists in understanding the use of pharmaceuticals in a therapeutic environment. Pharmacists will often know more, generally speaking, know more about drugs and the way drugs work, and importantly, how drugs interact, than your physician does, right? So this is all they do is drugs. All they do is drugs. So they're always doing drugs, whereas your physicians are doing a variety of things. Now, physicians know a lot about drugs, right? Because they need to, but a pharmacist can be a really great ally to a doctor because this is their specialty. Now, to become a pharmacist, you have to go through a six-year program and you become a doctor of pharmacy or PharmD. That doesn't mean you're a doctor in the same way as a physician is a doctor. You are a doctor of pharmacy. So you'll see a lot of these doctor of terms in healthcare. It just means that you have an advanced degree. So when I was coming up in the first 10 years of my career, so from the 90s, the early 90s to the early 2000s, it was pretty standard that the pharmacists I worked with had four-year degrees. Now today, that has been extended to a six-year program. So like other specialties, pharmacists can subspecialize. I had had friends who were oncology pharmacies, so they specialized in working with patients with cancer, and so they were the ones who would actually like make the chemotherapy, for example, because a lot of these things have to be custom made. So if you were going to a hospital to get chemotherapy, you would go to the oncology pharmacy, and an oncology pharmacist would probably prepare the specific dosages that your oncologist was recommending and would partner with your oncologist to come up with the right regimen of treatment. Nuclear medicine pharmacy is similar to that. So this is if you're going to do a study where they inject radioactive material into your body, the nuclear medicine pharmacist is the one who prepares the concoction that gets injected into your blood. So there's a bunch of different other specialties as well. But just to get a sense, in the hospital, in the clinical system, there are, you know, it's not just your CVS pharmacist who's handing you bottles of pills. They also do really some really complicated things. They're more like chemists. You can think of them more like chemists. So dentists, of course, hopefully you've all been to the dentist. Dentists typically get either the DDM or the DDS, so Doctor of Dental Medicine or Doctor of Dental Science. As far as I know, there's no difference, and I'm not really even sure historically what the difference is between those. But basically, you're going to be one or the other four-year degree. The first 2 years of dental medicine is almost identical to the first 2 years of medical school. And then instead of doing clinical rotations through all the different kinds of medicine, they go into doing, you know, dental care. You'll typically have a general dentistry degree. So your dentist, unlike your physician, your dentist can do 4 years and move and be out and start practicing. Your physician today has to do at least a residency. And so that's typically at least 3 years. So to become a physician is a seven-year process after a bachelor's degree. To become a general dentist is only a four-year process. Now, they can do further specialization. So if you've ever had your wisdom teeth yanked, that would have been an oral surgeon. So you would have to do further training for that. If you had braces, you'd go to get to an orthodontist. If you're having trouble with your gums, so as you get older, if you don't floss, you should definitely floss. But if you don't floss, your gums will start to recede, and then you may wind up having to have surgery to restore your gums. So definitely floss. So there's a lot of reasons why a lot of things, and then prosthodontics. So if you lose your teeth and need false teeth, your prosthodontist is the person that makes false teeth. All of these specialties require that you do the general dentistry training first, and then you do this as additional training. So you've probably been to one of these before. If you were ever injured in sports, you might have gotten sent to a physical therapist. If you had a serious injury with your hands, you young people might have gotten, that would probably be the only reason to go to occupational therapy. Occupational therapy does a lot of work with people who have had strokes and things like that as well. The way I think of it is physical therapy kind of works with the gross motor movements. So it's restoring your ability to walk, to move, and so forth. Occupational therapy focuses on functionality. So if you were in an accident and had your hand, maybe lost one of your arms, you might go to an occupational therapist to learn how to use your prosthetic, and then learn how to, you know, cook, or clean or do your job now in a different way. So occupational therapists help people solve problems when they have some new limitation. One of the cool things you'll see if you're ever in Hewitt is there is an occupational therapy lab that includes things like a full kitchen where they practice teaching people with disabilities how to use a kitchen. In a similar vein, recreational therapy. This is something that I knew nothing about because I worked in the Army. I worked in the acute care side, and recreational therapy is really a post-acute rehabilitation-based specialty, but it's a really cool one. And we have rec therapy here at UNH, not in my college, not in my department. And what they do is they take recreational activities and turn them into really kind of occupational therapy. So these two are very similar. So for example, you were in a car accident and injured your spine, and maybe you're now paraplegic. You can't use your legs. You're now confined to a wheelchair. Well, while you were in rehabilitation, a recreational therapist may come to see you and, you know, help you and say, they would say, what did you like to do before your injury? And you might say something like, well, I used to really like to ride my bike. And they say, well, that's great. So what we have is a hand cycle. So this is a bicycle with the hand grips allow you to pedal. So you can pedal the bicycle using your hands instead of your feet. And that's great, right? Of course, because now you're learning a skill that you want to do because, you know, you want to be able to go back out and ride your bicycle. But the therapeutic portion of this is in order for you to use the hand cycle, you have to learn how to make a transfer from your wheelchair to the hand cycle. And that is a new skill that you need to learn as a person who now is confined to a wheelchair. So it's making a transfer. And where else are you going to need to make a transfer? Well, you're going to need to make a transfer from your wheelchair to your bed, for example, to go to bed at night. You're going to need to be able to make a transfer from your wheelchair to a toilet. You're going to need to make a transfer from your wheelchair to a dinner chair or whatever else, right? So a new skill that you need as a person who is recently confined to a wheelchair is this ability to make transfers. So what recreational therapists try to do is they look for a thing that you want to do such that you have an internal motivation to want to do it. And then they turn that into a therapeutic intervention. So again, like teaching someone who's recently confined to a wheelchair, teaching them, giving them the ability to ride a hand cycle, which then teaches them how to do a transfer. Many of you probably have had therapy at some point, and one of the most common therapists that exist in the United States are licensed clinical social workers. So these are social workers that have a master's degree in therapy. So this is very common. Less common and requiring more training is a clinical psychologist. So whereas a clinical social worker is a 6-year degree, 4 years plus 2 years of therapy, clinical psychologist is 4 to 7 years of training. And clinical psychologists do some therapy type work, but a lot of them do specialize in testing. So they do high levels of testing. So for example, to determine the level of autism that a person might have, or some other learning disability. So you'll see clinical psychologists working in school systems, for example, that they do testing. So if you ever had an IED, but that's an explosive device, an independent learning I can't remember it right now. But a program where you had special needs addressed by the school, that would have been determined by your, at least in part, by your clinical psychologist. All right. So in that, that's kind of the broad field of allied health. Those were the licensed people. These are all people with licenses. So they have to get a license at the end of their training. But we have a lot of allied health people that don't have licenses. So we have a lot of different technicians and technologists that don't have licenses, such as a lab technologist that runs complex tests. So we have that program here at UNH. Occupational therapy technicians, physical therapy technicians, these are people that have a couple of years of training and work under the license of a occupational therapist or a physical therapist. Radiology technicians. So if you ever had an x-ray done, it was probably done by a rad tech, not by a radiologist. You probably never met the radiologist. So rad techs, that's what we call them in the business, run all the different imaging tools such as x-ray, MRI, and so forth, and ultrasound and so forth, right? So there's a lot of these different kinds of technicians. These pay really well and typically don't have, they have somewhere between a year and 2 years on average of training and good income associated with them. Here's one of the interesting things that I only recently found out. I was having a conversation while I was at my dentist with my dental hygienist, and she informed me that dental hygienists can work independently in Maine. So that means dental hygienists have to be licensed in all 50 states, as far as I know. In most states, a dental hygienist has to work under the license of a dentist. So they can't hang out a shingle and start advertising that they can do cleanings. But this is the person that typically does like your cleaning for you. In Maine, in order to address the shortage of dentists in Maine, Maine now allows dental hygienists to practice on their own. They don't have to work under a dentist. And so they get to keep more of their income, which is pretty cool. And a appropriate response, in my opinion, to a shortage of dentists. Now, near and dear to my heart, of course, are administrators, because that was my role. Now, administrators provide non-clinical support to the system. So this is administrators, the way I think of it is, you think of the Patriots, right? Well, the players on the field, they're going to be your physicians. They're the one that everybody's focused on. But, how does Gillette operate? Think about that. Who's selling the tickets? Who's making sure that the hot dog stand is open and the concession, all the other concessions and the merchandise that you just have to have is all operating? Well, that's going to be kind of the equivalent of your administrators. And it's a great field, right? It's a great field. There's a lot of low-level, entry-level stuff that doesn't require much education, such as ambulatory or patient service rep. We call them PSRs or ASRs. These are the people that run the front desk. They do more than answer the phone. They make sure that you have your scheduling and all these things are happening so that the doctor has all the patients that he or she can see. Revenue cycle analyst is somebody that billing in healthcare is incredibly complicated. And so the revenue cycle analyst is somebody that works to make sure that the doctor and the hospital get all the revenue that they're supposed to get when they do the work. Information systems analyst, right? So everything in healthcare is heavily IT now. One of the few licenses, in fact, the only license that I'm aware of, license meaning as opposed to certifications, the only license that I'm aware of on the administrative side is the nursing home administrator. So in every state, as far as I'm aware, in order to run a nursing home, you have to have a licensed nursing home administrator, LNHA. So I'm on the board of licensure for nursing home administrators in the state of New Hampshire. And you have to do, in addition to having an appropriate, you don't have to have a particular degree to be a nursing home administrator, but you have to have enough credits to show that you've learned about running a health, you have an understanding of healthcare. So you have to take courses like this one that you're in right now. Then in New Hampshire, you have to do a year-long, what's called an administrator in training program. So it's a, or we call it an AIT, where you work under the supervision of an experienced licensed nursing home administrator, and they teach you the ropes, and it's for a year. And then you'd have to take a national exam and a state exam in order to do it. So it's pretty serious stuff. And it's pretty serious stuff because you have incredible responsibility. And this is a great field for young people. And I typically send a couple of my students each year out to AITs after they graduate, and they do very well for themselves. And I'm happy to answer questions about that if you're interested. Administrators can move into all kinds of different functions, operations, generally the running of a hospital or running of a clinic, finance, which is what I did, you know, everything from getting the revenue that's supposed to come in to creating budgets and managing resources, IT, of course, human resources. I mean, the world is your oyster in healthcare, and most of them are not licensed. So whatever you're getting your degree in, you could potentially go on to get a job at a hospital working in some sort of administrative role. And this course would help you a lot with that because you'd have some of the terminology and you'd know some of the people who you're working with, such as, you know, the difference between a neurologist and a neurosurgeon. So what do we see for trends in healthcare? We're almost done. What do we see in trends in healthcare? Well, I mentioned earlier, we have a problem with too many specialists and not enough general practice or primary care providers. Again, that goes to, in particular, compensation, right? If you're going to go do a, you know, 7 or 8 years of training and you're now choosing between a specialty that's going to pay you $250,000 versus $500,000, you're probably going to think pretty long and hard before you decide to take the lower paying one. We also see a shortage of physicians in rural areas. Again, compensation doesn't go up. In fact, it goes down for most physicians if they move out to rural areas. And if you've got to spend 10 years getting training, that's a lot of income that you've given up, and you've probably taken on a huge amount of debt. And so you're not going to go to a rural area where you're going to get less pay. There are shortages of other kinds of staffing out in the rural areas as well, all the way down from physicians, all the way down to technicians. It's hard to retain people in the rural area. And that's a problem in states like New Hampshire, where we're about half, two-thirds rural. And then physician burnout. We're seeing a lot of challenges with physicians just getting exhausted and regretting their choices. Supply of medical professionals. So we said geographic maldistribution, right? So that's too many physicians and other kinds of providers in the cities, not enough in the country and or in the rural areas. Specialty maldistribution, largely because of compensation being distorted by government decisions about what different procedures will be paid and what different kinds of practices will be paid. And so, this kind of gets into the last sections of prices and allocation of resources, right? The government setting of prices instead of allowing the market to decide really does create mostly creates the problems that we're dealing with. So we create our own problem. I'll just leave that there. Some other trends and we'll end on this, some other trends in healthcare staffing, right? Healthcare delivery organizations, especially hospitals, are 50% or more, really their budget is spent on people. So if you look at the budget of a hospital, typically they're spending more than half of their expenses on paying salaries and wages. We're requiring higher and higher levels of training. So maybe down here, rising educational requirements, right? So that I talked about in my career, you know, from the early 90s through to the early 2000s, we went from requiring a pharmacist to have a 4-year degree to a 6-year degree. That's 2 more years of not earning a salary and 2 more years of student loans, right? So that's a lot of money. Physical therapy has gone from 4 to 7 years of, you know, 6 or 7 years of training. Nurses, the system is squeezing out 2 and 3 year RNs in favor of 4-year RNs. You know, what that does is a lot of people who might say, you know, I'd like to be a nurse, and I'd be willing to do 2 years of training, but 4 years is too much. We wind up losing those people to a different field. They often don't just say, all right, well, I guess I'll just do 4 years. What they say instead is, you know what, I'm going to be a rad tech instead, because that's a two-year program, not a 4-year program. So that's a problem and another reason why we see shortages. And then other increasing regulatory and educational requirements, such as more extensive licensing requirements, result in increased cost, both for the individual trying to earn the degree or the license. And then once those people have been trained, institutions have to pay them more because it costs them, you know, more effort to get there. All right. So that's a quick overview of healthcare professions in the United States. And we will talk more about technology soon.